It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Neil Conan is away. I'm Guy Raz. By the time Jennifer Trey graduated high school, she'd convinced herself she had, among other diseases, skin cancer, meningitis, and pancreatitis. The odd headache meant a brain tumor. Leg cramps meant Parkinson's, a stuffy nose, sinus cancer. If you haven't already figured it out, Jennifer Traeg is a hypochondriac, a condition that afflicts anywhere from 1 to 5% of Americans. Jennifer Traeg's new memoir about her hypochondria and the history of the condition is called Well Enough Alone. We'll speak with her this hour, and as always, we'd like to hear from you. Do you think you might be a hypochondriac, and why? Have you been accused of being one only to discover you actually really were sick? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can also share your experiences with us on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, making robots cute and cuddly. Why so many people fell for a trash compactor with big eyes. But first, Jennifer Traeg and the cultural history of hypochondriacs. She joins us now from member station KQED in San Francisco. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And now, when you were in the second grade, your Halloween assignment at school was to draw the scariest thing you ever saw. Can you tell us a story?
Yeah, I of course, while my friends and classmates were, you know, drawing werewolves and vampires, I drew an aneurysm.
a brain aneurysm.
Yeah, it's in fact what had killed my grandfather and was this absolutely the scariest thing I could think of, and drew a picture of a vein exploding, which is how I understood it. My mother, understandably not amused, was quite horrified and sent me to my room, as I recall.
You were, what, 8 years old at the time?
Yeah, seven, yeah.
I mean, have you been a hypochondriac most of your life?
Yeah, you know, I dabble. I have a lot of anxiety disorders. And hypochondria is, you know, in the rotation along with OCD and panic and anxiety and, you know, the grab bag of neuroses. But ever since I was about four, I remember thinking that there were things wrong with my body.
Now, hypochondria is something mocked and lampooned. It's not really sort of taken seriously, but you write that it is, at least from your perspective, something that is increasingly being taken seriously by the medical establishment. Why is that?
Well, there's a big financial incentive to do so. Hypochondria costs, it's estimated about $20 million a year in unnecessary tests and procedures. So it makes a lot of financial sense to figure out that someone's a hypochondriac and not, you know, actually a cancer or a cardiac disease patient. So I think HMOs are very invested in trying to root them out early and get them into treatment that really, really helps and really works. And part of that's removing the stigma and weeding out, you know, people who are truly sick from people who are truly sick with hypochondria.
This is a real condition. This is a condition that has been sort of described by psychologists, psychiatrists, and others, and studied?
Yeah, it is. And it's very old. It dates back to the 4th century BCE. The term was first coined by Hippocrates. And at that point, it was just a anatomical term. It was hypo underneath the chondrium, which was your rib cage. As time went on, it began to be associated with more symptoms. By the 2nd century, Galen had identified it and was describing it as a condition with, you know, various vague complaints. And it was taken very seriously. The popularity waned somewhat during the Middle Ages, but by the end of the Renaissance, there was full-blown hypochondriac chic. And the only thing I can liken
hypochondriac
it to—
Hypochondriac chic.
Yeah, it was strange to imagine now, but it was a very popular disease. It was a disease of the wealthy and the educated. It was taken very seriously. It was not, and today, you know, thanks to Woody Allen, and I truly mean thanks to Woody Allen, it's a funny disease, but at the time it was taken quite seriously. It was celebrated in lots of artwork and poems. There's a famous Pindaric ode by Lady Winchelsea called The Spleen. Molière wrote The Imaginary Invalid. He actually died shortly after playing the title role when he hemorrhaged on stage.
There's a famous painting of Marat bathing.
Right.
I wanted to ask you a serious question because a lot of your memoir is humorous and painful, but explain something to me. You write that hypochondriacs think they're sick, and in your case, it was the same because they really feel sick. You actually feel pain. You have symptoms. So where does it come from? How does that happen?
Right. And that's something I didn't know until I started doing the research for the book. I knew I was a hypochondriac, and I was embarrassed by that. And when I started doing the reading, I came to understand that, you know, I think I'm sick because I really do have symptoms. Hypochondriacs have this amazing talent for translating stress and anxiety into actual physical symptoms that you can't fake. It's just that there's no underlying pathology. You don't have cancer, but you truly do have, you know, a skull-crushing headache. Your hair truly is falling out. Your arm really is swollen. You do have mysterious bruising and rashes. It's just that there's no underlying disease besides the hypochondria. It's not killing you. Mm-hmm. You just think it is.
Jennifer, let's go to the phone lines. We've got Julie with us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Julie, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. I totally sympathize with you. I think I was probably in about eighth grade when I started to freak out because I was convinced that I was dying of skin cancer, you know, melanoma that had progressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to, you know, my mom took me to the dermatologist, blah, blah, blah. After that, I was convinced, you know, in high school that a lump I found was breast cancer, you know, and went to the doctor, had tests, you know, and I've been like this ever since. And it's really a terrible way to live. I mean, I kind of laugh about it with my friends and we kind of, you know, we laugh, but it really is a horrible thing to constantly worry that every little thing you feel is actually some deadly disease. With me, it tends to be cancer. I really worry about cancer because I do have it in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's kind of crippling. Like there were actually times when I would say, oh, I'd like to go get a massage, but no, you know, I need to find out if I'm dying first. I know that sounds silly, but you know, I need to go get this test and make sure this mole isn't, you know, cancerous. And actually, the really interesting thing about this is that I did have a melanoma. While I was pregnant with my daughter, I caught, maybe it's partly because I'm such a hypochondriac. I mean, I go to the doctor, you know, and I went to my dermatologist and caught a really thin, early stage melanoma.
Wow. So had you been accused of hypochondria and after you actually were really sick, did your doctor treat you differently?
You know, I think that my mom, who had always just said, oh, come on, Julie, this is getting ridiculous. I think she decided that she wouldn't give me such a hard time anymore. But, you know, I don't want to make it out to be like, oh, these hypochondriacs really are always sick. You know, this, I think it was kind of a fluke thing that I actually did have a melanoma. But, you know, and I, since I had that melanoma, I've been in therapy for the hypochondria, because, like I said, it's really crippling. And plus, I think you get to the point where you realize that the worry is not, I mean, the disease, honestly, is not even quite as bad as the worry, you know?
So. Yeah, hypochondria actually has a 5% cure rate, which makes it less curable than horrible diseases like leukemia and Hodgkin's and chronic heart disease. It can be a really crippling disease. Fortunately, it's getting much more treatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My therapist, you know, and it was just kind of, you know, positive thinking and, you know, don't automatically assume the worst. And, you know, we went through a lot of role-playing things. And, I mean, it really has helped me. I'm doing better with it.
Mm-hmm. Good.
But you know, it's one that you just have to assume, okay, that, you know, and now, actually, my problem is that, you know, since I had this melanoma, I'm constantly feeling around my lymph nodes, like, oh, did it spread? Even though, you know, there's a tiny chance that it would because it was so early. But, you know, it's one of those things where you just, it's a delicate road to travel because, you know, every once in a while you are sick, you know,
right.
And you can let it kind of take over or not. But,
right.
But anyway, I sympathize with you. It's a hard thing to deal with.
Well, Julie, I hope you continue to feel well.
Yeah, and Julie,
well, thank you.
Julie, good luck, and thanks so much for the call. We wish you well.
Thanks.
Jennifer Traig, Talk a little bit about the stigma. I mean, how do people treat you as a hypochondriac?
It's so embarrassing. Really, I mean, I am actually sick in a number of ways. I do have all kinds of conditions. I have eczema. I have IBS, and there are a few things more. You know,
and you've written a memoir about your OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, but the hypochondria is the one I'm really ashamed of. I think because it's the boy who cried wolf disease, and it really wears out people's patience, as it should. It's annoying. You're the person who's disappointed when the path report comes back benign. You know, you're always looking for the tumor. And you're taking resources away from people who truly do have tumors. There's nothing more embarrassing than when I have to tell someone who actually has a really devastating disease what I'm working on. And I always try to, you know, make up something. Oh, I'm working on disease. I don't want to tell them that I'm working on the disease about imaginary disease.
What about doctors? I mean, when you would go visit doctors, would they just sort of sigh and say, oh, here comes the hypochondriac again?
No, I'm in...
I mean, you're the daughter of a doctor, for one thing we should
mention.
Right,
right. And probably to my detriment, I'm a model patient. I know how... And I'm never trying to fool my doctor. When I go in, I really do have symptoms and I really do think I'm sick. But I know how not to seem like a crackpot. And so, you know, doctors have always taken me seriously, whether or not they should. But doctors, yeah, hate, many dislike treating hypochondriacs. They're very frustrating patients. Interns call us GOMERS, which stands for get out of my emergency room. We're also known as turkeys, crackpots. A physician will sometimes jokingly ask for a patient's serum porcelain level when he suspects a patient is a crackpot.
Jennifer Traeg is with us. She is a self-diagnosed hypochondriac and the author of the book Well Enough Alone, A Cultural History of My Hypochondria. You can join the conversation by giving us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. We'd love to hear from you via the internet. Drop us an email. Our address is talk@npr.org. I'm Guy Raz. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Guy Raz, here in Washington, D.C. In her new book, Jennifer Traeg writes, I had my first heart attack when I was 18. I was striding across campus when it hit like a bomb going off in my chest. My left arm went numb, and it got harder and harder to breathe. I was used to being sick. By the time I started college, I'd already had skin cancer, meningitis, pancreatitis, and blood poisoning. Of course, she wasn't having a heart attack. That's just one of the self-diagnoses Jennifer Traeg talks about in her book, Well Enough Alone, A Cultural History of My Hypochondria. You can read more about her litany of diseases in an excerpt at npr.org. Jennifer Traeg is our guest, and as always, you can join us at 800-989-8255. Are you a hypochondriac? Tell us your story. Again, that's 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Jennifer Traeg, I want to read an email we received from Deanna in Portland. She writes, I used to be a hypochondriac. Some would argue that I still am, though I know I am nothing like I used to be. I spent my teenage years reading Gray's Anatomy and the Medical Dictionary and recently aced a class in medical terminology as a result. At one time, I was convinced for years, mind you, that I had AIDS. I also thought that I had lung cancer and numerous less serious ailments. It was about with a real serious life-threatening disease that finally cured me. Have you ever been accused of being a hypochondriac only to discover that actually you really were sick? You really had a disease?
I have all kinds of diseases. It's just that none of them are fatal. But hypochondriacs, that's the problem. And the reason that hypochondriacs are so hard to treat, they don't get sick any less often than people who don't have it. They do get cancer. They do get heart disease. They do get all the terrible diseases that they, you know, they fear that other people don't, but they still get them. And every doctor has stories about, you know, a patient that they sent away 20 times who, and my dad had one himself, who, you know, later new technology showed that they were sick all the time. It's theorized now that one of the most famous hypochondriacs of all time, Darwin, who was just a prodigious hypochondriac and had several hypochondriac children, that in fact he may have been suffering from a mysterious tropical disease that he picked up on his travels on the mm-hmm. Beagle.
We have several emails from listeners asking about diseases that are still undiagnosed. Liz from Hercules, California writes, there are very hard diseases to diagnose, like autoimmune diseases, celiac disease. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Most sufferers of celiac, for example, are told they are hypochondriacs and sent home. Is that something you often hear?
Yeah. And nothing is scarier to me than those sort of diseases like the autoimmune ones and like chronic fatigue syndrome. Fibromyalgia in particular just terrifies me because we don't really know what it is yet. I suspect down the road we'll find out that it was four different diseases that all got lumped together. I think there's, you know, a lot of infectious diseases we don't know much about. But yeah, there are diseases that are notoriously hard to diagnose. Myasthenia gravis is one and of course one that I often think I have for that reason.
I want to ask you about the news. Say you hear about a pandemic, like avian bird flu, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Do you start to think you have it?
Oh, yeah. That's the thing about hypochondria. It makes every disease contagious, and you can catch things through the TV. And, yeah, I have everything. My medical show watching is now severely limited. I love them, but I'm not allowed to watch House by myself.
And what about the internet? I mean, there's so much quack medical science available out there, and there's some good sites too, WebMD. But has it sort of created a whole segment of Americans who are becoming hypochondriacs?
Yeah, it's a new condition. It has been termed rather predictably cyberchondria. Yeah, and I think it's defined. You have to visit a medical website 6 times in a month to qualify. Which, you know, come on.
And did you find yourself
That's
doing
much.
That?
Oh yeah, I'm on all the time. I like to think that I'm an informed, you know, an informed patient. But yeah, I'm on too much. And the problem with websites is while they can be incredibly helpful, some of them can be a little inflammatory and they have these symptom matchers. So you very quickly escalate from, you know, headache to sinus cancer.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones now. We've got, let's see here, Jim from Sacramento, California is on the line with us. Jim, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share with you and Jennifer, it's kind of a funny story. I wanted to see if she can relate to this. I actually have a obsessive compulsive disorder and a pretty highly functioning normal guy, except for when this sort of anxiety takes over. And there was a time, I don't know, maybe 6-7 months ago where I actually woke my wife up in the middle of the night and was like beyond stressed about the fact that the scratch paper pile and the printing paper pile had become merged, and I couldn't believe that this would happen in our apartment. And there's lots of instances of weird things like that are related to the anxiety, and it's actually caused problems with my relationship. So I just wondered how maybe Jennifer, if your book or if you could share with us now how your personal relationships are kind of impacted by these anxiety related conditions.
And Jennifer, there has been a link made between obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, and hypochondria.
Yeah, 2/3 of hypochondria sufferers suffer from an underlying condition, and about it's been estimated that up to 1/3 of those have OCD, also sometimes depression, anxiety disorders. And I have OCD myself, and I know it's related. Yeah.
And how does it manifest itself? I mean, what would you do?
I can't drop it. And when I have an OCD fear that I've left the iron on, it's the exact same pattern. We're, you know, constantly circling around. So, you know, with OCD, I might circle the locks in my house. And with hypochondria, I'm circling the mole. I just keep coming back to the mole. But it very much feels like the same impulse to me.
Jim, thanks so much for calling in. Thank you. We have an email here from Alex in Salt Lake. Jennifer, he asks, what is the opposite of a hypochondriac? Or in other words, someone who is sick but pretends not to be sick.
Right. Well, that's actually a form of hypochondria in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, hypochondria is this big umbrella. And there's a group of hypochondriacs who are so scared they're sick, they won't get any medical treatment. I had a distant cousin who was one of these and was convinced she had stomach cancer and just got sicker and sicker and finally was in so much pain she went to the doctor and her stomach tumor was delivered a couple hours later, and they named him Francis. And he's healthy and well. Yeah, they are. And then, you know, there are people who are just stoic and suck it up.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Jerry is on the phone with us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Jerry, welcome.
Hi, how are you all doing today?
Great.
My point was that I have a relative who's constantly coming down with one thing or another. A headache ends up being a brain tumor, much of what you've already spoke about. My point was that she, what we do is we try to talk to her, rationalize it out. Is it really a symptom? Are you stressed? And a lot of times it will come down to stress. You know, she's stressed over the children, the bills, the husband, you know, the income situation. And then she'll see something on television or so many commercials for this will cure you or that'll cure you like we've never seen before. And she'll fall right into that. The worst part is she's in the medical field.
Hmm. And Jennifer, did you find that, you know, late night commercials with a cure-all miracles, you'd be sort of calling up and ordering some of these things?
I'm cheap. I never order anything I can get for free from the sample closet at the doctor's office. But yeah, you know, TV it's infectious. Yeah, you catch things. And the caller had mentioned that the family member is in the medical field, and this definitely happens. I don't know if it's partly that hypochondriacs are attracted to it. I've worked in doctor's offices most of my adult life. Many of my family members are in the field, and it's very common for medical students. I think the number is something like 3/4 of them during the first couple of years of medical school will go through a brief bout of hypochondria because they're reading about all these diseases. They're under tremendous stress, and they all think they have Hodgkin's or, you know, some other lymphoma.
Hmm. Thanks.
The other part of that is how many times a day do you wash your hands?
I'm pretty good now, but yeah, I've definitely gone through periods of my life where I don't know, 50, 100 plus.
Wow.
Well, here's one for you. The question came to be, you wash your hands after you use a public restroom, but then you go to grab the door handle that the guy before you has just used the bathroom and didn't wash his hands. And that's always seemed to be a little joke because we all hang on to a piece of the paper that they provide to dry your hands with to open the door.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, the best hopes for you. And, you know, there's a lot of diseases out there. We're just learning a lot of things.
Thanks so much for the call, Jerry.
Likewise. Goodbye. Thank you.
I wonder if in a way, Jennifer Traeg, hypochondria is a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, does it actually make you more susceptible to being sick?
I wonder that. I mean, this past year I've had 5 different skin infections requiring treatment.
And you have eczema. I mean, you describe
I do have eczema, so I'm prone. Mm-hmm. I'm prone to them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I definitely receive far more treatment than any of my friends. And most of the time it's for something I actually need. I wonder. And then, you know, I mean, a hospital is a good place to get sick. And if you spend enough time there, you can pick something up.
You write about food poisoning and how it's the ideal disease or the ideal condition for a hypochondriac to pick up. Why is that?
Well, one, you truly are sick. Two, the thing I like about food poisoning, we know this is terrible, is that it's communal. You are in this together. You know, usually someone else has eaten the bad tuna salad with you, so you have a little pal on the journey there. In many ways, it's the inverse of hypochondria. And the other thing is, you know, with hypochondria, you're always imagining that you're sick when you're not. And with food poisoning, there's some denial going in that, oh, no, couldn't be the tuna. No, I'm not sick. Just a little car sickness. It'll go away. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you really have it.
Let's speak with Diana. She's in Birmingham, Alabama. Diana, welcome.
Hey, I'm actually on my way to the doctor and turned the radio on and heard this conversation. And I don't really consider myself a hypochondriac, but I've always, I mean, ever since I was little, knew I had something. I mean, the first time I saw a freckle, I noticed a freckle on my stomach, it was skin cancer. One time I was like 12 years old and saw what now I know is my heart beating in my stomach and swore I was pregnant and never had even. So it's just so weird to hear this. Maybe I do have a little bit of hypochondria. I'm definitely a little OCD. So I was just amazed that I'm not crazy.
No. And in some ways, you know, I've been viewing my various pathologies as a benefit in some way. You know, one of the earlier callers who diagnosed her own melanoma very, very early, there's certain benefits to being, you know, hyper aware of what's going on in your body.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I didn't know what was wrong with me a few years ago, and it turns out I had an autoimmune disease, Graves' disease. So my body was attacking my thyroid.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were all of these symptoms going on, and the doctors couldn't find it. And, of course, I thought I was crazy and went to a million doctors, and they didn't find it until I got a goiter. And then it was like, oh, I'm not crazy. There really is, like, all these things wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think now I'm a little bit paranoid that I have, maybe it wasn't Graves' disease because I'm still having these symptoms and I don't, you know, but I'm on this medicine. And so it's just a constant, like, well, what's wrong with me now? What's wrong with me now? So.
Mm-hmm. Well, Diana, thanks so much for the call and good luck today.
Thanks.
Okay. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go back to a caller. We have Mike is on the line in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Mike, welcome.
Welcome. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about, I'm wondering, Jennifer, does this condition, does it manifest itself in some of your lucid dreams? I mean, we all have some of those, maybe their sense of control having to do with, you know, controlling our lives, you know, losing our teeth, or we, in our dream, we find a scratch or something on our face, and as we pick at it in the dream, worse things happen. And I'm wondering if as a hypochondriac, if you've noticed that your dreams are very lucid, or if that also kind of impacts your condition. And I can, I'm driving, so I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you.
I do. And that's one thing about people with somatoform disorders. We manifest symptoms, and I try not to think about things I don't want to get, because if I think about it, and especially if I dream it, it often shows up the next day. And it's never anything very serious. Mm. It's, you know, a pimple or a sty. And I don't know if subconsciously I feel it coming on and haven't noticed it yet, but often I'll dream about something and then develop it the next day. And I've now started doing that. I got married last week and a very patient man, and have since had dreams about him getting sick. And then the next day I dreamt about him having, you know, tenderness in his side, and a couple days later he was complaining of tenderness in his side. And I thought, oh, now I have hypochondria by proxy.
Jennifer, you actually ultimately decided to treat your condition. Can you talk about what you did and whether it was successful?
It was very successful, and it was also completely accidental. I'm a person who probably should have been on Prozac since the time it came out, but because I'm hypochondriac, really worried about side effects and didn't go on it until I was diagnosed with IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, which, you know, I'm very proud to have. even though it takes place in your stomach, it's caused by a problem with brain chemistry, essentially. It's caused by an inability to process serotonin very well. And so you're prescribed selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, which worked like a charm on the IBS and also worked like a charm on the hypochondria. And I went almost to zero, spending time on, you know, various medical websites and obsessing. And I'll still have the fear, but I can drop it right away.
So, I mean, so essentially you are hypochondria-free at this moment?
Well, I don't know that I'd say that. I would say I'm high functioning. I'm doing quite well. And the other thing I did was cognitive behavior therapy, which is often prescribed for hypochondria now, often in use along with an SSRI, which is very effective. And one of the earlier callers had talked about when the family member was having problems, they would talk her through it and try to have her see it rationally, which is basically what CBT is.
So probably briefly, for the rest of your life, you'll probably have to have some kind of treatment like this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, for me, I'm very lucky. I'm on the very mild side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. There are people who are truly crippled by it, and I have a more or less normal life, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm a little worried about having kids. I expect I will be, you know, sticking thermometers in them daily. But, yeah.
Well, Jennifer Traeg is a self-diagnosed hypochondriac. Her book, Well Enough Alone, A Cultural History of My Hypochondria, is out now. There's a link to her website at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. She joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Jennifer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, the secret to making people fall for a robot. What is it about Wally that makes him seem so human? I'm Guy Raz. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Guy Raz in Washington, in for Neil Conan, while he takes a few days of well-deserved time off. Here are some headlines from other stories we're following today here at NPR News. The American Academy of Pediatrics says some children as young as 8 should be given anti-cholesterol drugs to help them avoid future heart problems. The new guideline is based on mounting evidence that damage leading to heart disease begins early in life. And aid for Africa, and whether enough, is coming from the world's major economic powers. It's in the spotlight at the Group of Eight annual summit. The G8 members met with African leaders at this week's meeting, which is taking place in northern Japan. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more coming up later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, age and the presidential campaign. We'll talk about when old is too old. That's tomorrow in this hour. But now, how do you take a trash compactor, attach it to binoculars, and make it cute and cuddly? Well, the creators of the new film Wall-E managed to pull that off. Wall-E, the robot, is a rusty piece of metal machinery, and he's become an instant classic. Matthew Battles writes about this in the Boston Globe, and he talks about how animators made Wall-E so endearing, how they take other characters like Mickey Mouse and E.T. and figure out ways to make them more appealing to us humans. Now, before we cue in the collective, tell us what your favorite animated character is and who he is or she and why. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, as always, is talk@npr.org. You can also share your experiences with us on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Matthew Battles, the contributor to the ideas section, rather, of the Boston Globe, is with us from the studios of the Christian Science Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Matthew, what makes a robot like Wall-E so charming?
Well, you know, it has to do, I think, more than anything else with our evolutionary background as human beings. What robot designers have discovered is the same thing that animators discovered, Walt Disney discovered in the 1920s, that if you throw a few cuteness cues at us as viewers, you're able to win our hearts very quickly. And you can take even a very sort of humdrum, rusty bucket of bolts and throw some big eyes at us and some clumsy movements and win our hearts very quickly.
Let's talk about Wall-E for a moment. He is a trash compactor on tracks, like tank tracks almost, with a binocular head and these stubbly fingers. But actually, all of those things were very carefully planned out, right?
Yeah, I think they were. You know, in fact, Andrew Stanton, the writer and director of Wall-E, talks about how looking at a pair of binoculars gave him an instant vision of character. He saw a head there. But what works for us as viewers is that those are big eyes in those binoculars. And those big eyes, again, cue us to care about this little creature. The same thing with his squat body, with his stubby arms and clumsy movements. These are all infantile features, and it's the infantile that gets us going.
It's almost the way Walt Disney made a mouse such a cute and enduring figure, a creature.
That's right. Go ahead.
And oftentimes we hear about panda bears, for example. Panda bears being the most popular animal in the zoo, the most popular character for children. But of course, rats, for example, it's difficult to make a rat cute.
It is indeed. And, you know, Stephen Jay Gould famously pointed out in an essay once, Mickey Mouse started out decidedly more rat-like. He had a really thin tail and a thin nose, and he looked like a rat in Steamboat Willie, his 1929 debut. And over the years, Disney transformed him into a cherubic mouse, much easier to handle.
Now, you write about how some folks at MIT are actually studying this. They're studying robots and have been studying this for a while. What have they discovered?
Well, yeah, there's a number of researchers at MIT, some of whom are well known in the media, Rodney Brooks and Cynthia Brazil, who've worked on robots that that have humanoid features and not only act in a humanoid fashion, but also can learn to respond to human social cues. Now, the thing that's really interesting about their work to me is that they're not trying to create an android, you know, a simulacrum of a human being, a machine that would convince us that it's a human. What they're trying to do is create a functional machine that can do tasks but can also interact with human beings, about which human beings can feel more comfortable, and that can learn from us.
Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing about this film is there's no dialogue in the first 40 minutes, but it's almost impossible not to be bowled over by the charm of this trash compactor robot with binocular head.
Yeah, it is quite striking, and a number of critics have commented on it. And I think, again, that gets to the sort of infantile nature of WALL-E. If he had a sophisticated vocabulary, I don't think he'd strike the same chords in viewers that he does as a kind of monosyllabic infant robot.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller. Scott is on the line with us from Twin Falls, Idaho. Scott, welcome.
Hi. This is a very interesting topic. I'm really interested in animation, and I have kids, so it's perfect for me. One of the most amazing animated characters, and it's a little bit off the subject of what you're talking about, because the characters you've been describing all have, you know, faces, features like that we can all relate to. But the Disney Aladdin had a magic carpet. Hmm. That was incredibly expressive, and you knew exactly what it was feeling and thinking and doing, and the expressions that it was trying to relate just through the movements of this rug. Basically, it was a really, really interesting and really neat, and struck me as one of the most amazing animated features I've ever seen, characters I've ever seen. So, and I'll put my comments up here. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Scott. And that's interesting, the point he raises, Matthew Battles, because gestures are obviously so important in creating an animated character that people, humans, will find appealing.
They are indeed, and I think you can take something that's quite distant in terms of design and function from an organic form and animate it in a way that makes it come alive. I think also of another Disney classic, Beauty and the Beast, and the many inanimate objects that are animated in that story become characters. Even the Czech avant-garde animator Jan Švankmajer often does these stop-motion animated classics that use things like egg beaters, and they come alive as well. So in the gesture, in the drama of the movement, you get character in ways that you can't get from a static representation.
We're talking to Matthew Battles. He's a contributor to the Ideas section at the Boston Globe. We're talking about The Huggable Machine, an article he's written about what makes the robot WALL-E so charming. Give us a call. Tell us who or what your favorite animated character is and why. Our number here is 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org. Matthew Battles, I want to ask you about the hands, WALL-E's hands. He's got two fingers on each side, mm-hmm. but these sort of stubbly, bulky, metallic fingers. But there's something very compelling about them as well.
Well, you know, yes, there is. And I mean, it's two stubby fingers and a thumb. And I think that thumb is important in a way that a kind of classic robot hand, a kind of two-fingered claw, would not be, like a lobster claw. I think that thumb adds a human dimension. Also, you know, there's an extent to which a robot's task in an animated film is to overcome his robot being, to overcome his metallic nature. And with the way Wally gestures, the way he tenderly picks a shoot of a plant, these are movements that show him becoming more human-like despite the fact that he's made out of metal.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Martin. He's on the line with us from Santa Clara, California. Martin, welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. Certainly like the show. The only comment I'll make is that, you know, certainly Wally, I saw the movie, I thought it was great, but it seems for animated characters, on top of being infantile, it's also the diminutive position that they're small, like Donkey and Shrek. Very rarely do you find yourself finding some attachment to a very large animated character like the Iron Giant. The other thing, though, I was going to comment on is that in robotics, though, there's a whole zone. Once you approach, you know, the fact that they're too human-like, then we actually abhor them. And so I'm wondering if, like, successful animated movies like Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, where, you know, these characters actually you look human, they don't do as well as animated characters that are very childlike. Anyway, you'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks so much, Martin. And Matthew?
Yeah, Martin makes a great point. You know, when you look at the whole range of sort of representations of robots in the history of film and television, you know, you get these menacing androids, these built objects that scare us with their uncanny similarity to human beings. And some great science fiction narratives are built out of that problem. I think that was most important sort of early in the middle of the 20th century, when writers like Isaac Asimov were writing their kind of epics and space operas about robots, the fear that we had that technology would take our place. And while that fear is still very important to us, I think our worries about it have become more nuanced. Martin's also certainly correct in how important the stature is of these robots. Wally clearly has a debt to E.T. the extraterrestrial, mm-hmm. who also looks up with those big, limpid eyes. By contrast, the nemesis of Wally in this film, the autopilot, he hangs from the ceiling. He's always looking down on us, always glowering down with this big red eye that mm-hmm. comes right out of 2001, A Space Odyssey, Hal's eye from that film.
And he mentions, of course, as you say, the diminutive features, like a human baby. And that's really part of the thinking that goes into this, right?
It is indeed. And again, citing Stephen Jay Gould and also the work by Rodney Brooks and Sidney Brazil at MIT, if we want to interact, if roboticists want us to interact with their machines, they do well to emulate these stubby creatures. In fact, a more recent version of the robots built at MIT, Cog and Kismet, a more recent version actually has a furry face and tufted ears and looks like a creature from a Disney movie.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Jesse. He's on the line with us from Nevada. Jesse, welcome.
Yeah, hi. I'm 32, and when I was a kid, R2-D2 was top-notch. He was the coolest dude, right? So as time progressed, you know, I got a little older, and then Short Circuit came out, and I was just wondering, you know, if there was a planning behind the design of Wally around Johnny Number 5 and what the reasoning was for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of people have mentioned the resemblance to Short Circuit, to R2-D2 as well. There's also a robot marooned on the moon in the Nick Park Wallace and Gromit classic, A Grand Day Out, and Wally's movements seem very similar to that robot as well. I think all of these robots are in a kind of line of family descent. They're all related to each other, and I think you can trace that relationship back to Mickey Mouse.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, thanks so much for the call.
Sure thing.
And Jennifer is on the line with us from Sacramento, California. Jennifer?
Hi, I was calling to say my favorite character is Donald Duck.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
He's so human. He represents the frustrations we feel in life where, despite your best efforts, sometimes things just don't go your way. And he shows the imperfections that we have. And I love the fact that there's characters that aren't always perfect, And don't always have the fairy tale ending, mm-hmm. despite the fact they're animated.
And Matthew Bettles, I mean, is that the case? I mean, there are certain animals that are easier to make cute. And I mean, Donald Duck, you know, he's a duck. Some people might regard
that's
ducks.
That's very true. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's very true. I think he's a duck is easier than a goose, and Donald looks more like a duckling than a duck. So in that sense, he's got everything in his favor. He's white and chubby and fluffy, and yes, it also has to do with story. You know, a character like Donald Duck, he's an organic creature at heart, and so he doesn't face one of the problems that robot characters face, which is that somebody built them. They have to have a reason to exist. In Wally's case, that becomes an occasion for story in and of itself. So animators and storytellers who work with robots work with that limitation as well, but can turn it into something on their side.
Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And let's go to one last call. Shiv is on the air with us from Sunnyvale, California.
Hi. My favorite, I wouldn't exactly call it my favorite, but Eve from the movie Wall-E is definitely an interesting character mm-hmm. because, like you mentioned, Wall-E has eyes, hands, and even legs. And the tracks that he uses are actually legs. But Eve, all they had was the LED, blue LED lights and the eyes. And I think they did an amazing job in transforming Eve from a from an angry robo in the beginning to a human robo at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Eve is a great example of this kind of thing, actually, and a great example also of how the audience for these movies, I mean, we're used to technology now in a way that we weren't even 10 or 20 years ago. And so we're personifying the cell phones and the iPods in our lives. And it's very easy with a few cues to make these things come to life for us.
Mm-hmm. Shiv, thanks so much for the call. And we'll go to one final call. Julia's on the line with us from Overland Park in Kansas. Julia?
Hi. One of my favorite characters, and they've never done, to my knowledge, a full length based on it, is the Lamps, the Disney Pixar Lamps.
Yeah. Matthew?
The mother and child.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, that lamp?
Yeah, well, they have starred in their own shorts, but you know, there's an interesting thing about the lamps that they actually prefigure, I believe, an invention that comes out of the MIT robotics laboratories, a lamp, a desk lamp that responds to the person sitting at the desk, that turns on, that cues into our eye movements and lights what we need lit, that reminds us of things we need to look at. So they've. And there's one case of art inspiring science, I think.
Mm-hmm. Julia, cool. Thanks. Yeah, Julia, thanks so much for giving us a call.
Thank you.
Bye. And Matthew Battles, essentially animators. Now we're going to be looking at Wall-E and presumably modeling future characters on him.
He certainly will become part of the family history of the cute and cuddly machine. There's no doubt about that.
An instant classic, as they said. Mm-hmm. As they said, Matthew Battles was with us from the studios of the Christian Science Center in Boston. He's a contributor to the Ideas section of the Boston Globe. His article is called "The Huggable Machine." It appeared in today's paper. Matthew Battles, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow we will talk about age and politics. When is old too old? Join us for that. I'm Guy Raz. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.